Welcome to Coach and the Doctor. Thanks to Gildacare, support coordinators, where it takes a village.
Hi, and welcome to another great episode with two fantastic guests. Melanie Dimmitt is a writer, author, editor, and broadcaster. And most importantly, I suppose, she's also a mum with two kids, one with a profound physical disability. First up, though, after the break, Matt Runnels, a mental health and suicide advocate. Matt has lived experience of suicide ideation and also understands the stigma that it creates on a worldwide scale. That's after the break on Coach and the Doctor. Brought to you by Gildacare, support coordinators who specialise in, amongst many things, psychosocial recovery coaching.
Are you or someone you know in need of a compassionate support coordinator? Gildacare is your team of trusted, caring and professional support coordinators. We'll make the NDIS process easy for you and your loved ones to navigate. We'll coordinate all your care and support, specialist support and, if required, psychosocial recovery coaching. GILDA, Gildacare Support Coordination. We make the NDIS process stress-free. Visit us at gildacare.com.au.
J-Man inspires and supports NDIS participants to live their best lives and promotes experiences for people with a disability. The NDIS can be confusing, so if you're thinking about applying for funding or not sure how your plan actually works, J-Man can help and guide you through every step of the process at no cost to you. jman.com.au. That's jaeman.com.au. Now is the time to get the most out of your NDIS. Call us for a free consultation. 1-800-JMAN.
You're listening to Coach and the Doctor. Thanks to Gildacare, support coordinators, where, of course, it takes a village. I'm Coach, not a real coach. Doctor, not a real doctor. Hello.
Hello, Coach. How are you today?
Great. And I think the last time we did a podcast, or when we recorded a podcast, I said it's raining in Melbourne. Guess what? It's raining in Melbourne again.
Because it's the same day.
Wow.
We record six a day.
We do. We do. We're so dedicated to our job. Matt Runnels, talk about dedication, mental health and suicide advocate, is on Zoom with us. Hello, Matt.
G'day, mate. Thanks for having us. Appreciate opening these lines of conversation, this meaningful stuff that we do every day. So I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, that's actually a good way to start. Matt,
well, it's not a great way to finish if that was...
Matt, it is a serious subject, isn't it? This is a serious subject. We're talking about, you're a mental health advocate, you create awareness, acceptance, education, connection within communities to overcome the stigma and effects of suicide on a global scale. How do you get out of bed every morning, mate?
Well, I think it's exactly that. Like, as I said, it's going to be pretty refreshing to have a chat to some, you know, two blokes that are just real and authentic. And I think that that's the key to all of this, is for far too long we've carried around these topics and themes with such darkness and doom and gloom that nobody wants to talk about it. Nobody wants to do it. So, you know, we're just trying to bring some life back to something that could be a little bit more positive. So, you know, as I said, I don't think there's any secrets to what I do. It's just more authenticity and the world's aching for it. So I guess for me to get out of bed every day, I just know what it's like to live at the bottom, and I wanted to see what happened if I didn't, if you know, what it would look like to not live at the bottom. And so I went on that journey, and I think that's what gets me out of the bed every day, is I now know that something else is possible. And there's levels to this game. I know it sounds cliche, there's levels to everything in life, but I'm seeing that in full turn now, that just how well you look after self, after yourself, and just what magic you can create for other people in doing so. So, yeah, I live a happy, healthy, fulfilling life, and I enjoy every single part of it.
But it wasn't always like that. You survived several suicide attempts. How did you get there? How did you get to that point to wanting to take your own life? And I guess what led you to that point?
Yeah, I guess for me, you know, I've just had a bloke drop into the office already this morning. We had a really good chat about this exact situation. And I feel like for me, it was just come down to being misunderstood. You know, this thing up here for me goes through a million thoughts a day. And if you're up there by yourself, it's a very lonely and dangerous place sometimes. So to be able to be understood, I mean, the human being's fundamentally wired for love, belong, connection. And all we ever want, I'll argue it black and blue with anyone, is to love and be loved, to be seen, heard and valued for who we are. So when you're not understood for that, when you're not seen, when you're not listened to, when you're ignored, I guess these are the things that led me to feel the suicidal ideation that once went on when I sat outside the classroom doors when I'd been booted out of the classroom, and it stemmed from there. I mean, I rocked up every single day at school with intent to want to learn. I don't know how long that intent lasted some days, but you know, when you're removed from the classroom and you're listening to everybody else have fun in there, and you start to believe these narratives and stories about yourself. And I started to create this own story in my mind that I was a burden on every single person I come in contact with, that I was worthless because I couldn't achieve what everybody else could, or sit still or focus or concentrate. And I was a failure, and I felt like I was letting down my parents who had put a lot of time and effort into me. And I guess when you're that young, you don't talk about these things because of the taboo and the stigma, especially a young male going back as many years as when I was struggling. And so I sat on the outside of those classroom doors and I stewed on it and stewed on it and stewed on it until I created the conditioning that I still believe to this day. You know, when I'm at my darkest, I still believe I'm a burden on every single person I come in contact with. I still believe I'm worthless, and I still believe I'm a failure. So I guess in that regard, from school, then I went to plumbing. I was physically, emotionally abused by my boss, and it just stemmed them stories of burden, worthless, and failure just continued to reoccur in my mind, and I started to believe it. And the only way out, I felt, was to take my life by my own two hands. And I mean, I'd tried everything else that society had suggested to me, was to go seek help and support and to get medication and get a diagnosis. And I did all that, and nothing changed for me. And everyone I spoke to was either believed that I was too much or didn't want to talk and hold space for those difficult conversations around mental health, which, you know, it gives me great satisfaction to sit here and be able to have these conversations and to know that the place we're in right now is, we've come a long way and we can now do that. And there is people out there that care.
Would it have been different if you could have had these conversations 15 years ago?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. To be able to have the conversations and just be real and talk about what's really important. And the thing that goes on up here is the most important thing that we possess. So, you know, to just have authentic conversations about the shit that goes on in our world. I mean, we all go to bed with problems, but a lot of us believe it's sexy to hide it. And I did too for a long time. So it's nice to have those supports around me where they open that dialogue for me and allow me just to express who I am. They don't try to solve me problems or heal me or make me believe that I do need healing or solving. They just allow me to speak and talk and get the shit off my chest. And when I do that, then we're both in a better position to navigate our way through it.
So your family life was okay. It seems like it was around school and when you left the family environment. Would that be fair?
Yeah, so I was at high school when I started to notice that things were going wrong in my world. I've had the most amazing parents possible from day one to this very moment I'm in. And, you know, I ran away from them because I believed that I was a burden on them. And that dull ache of the love and support that they shed for me, I mean, they shed immense amounts of it for me from day one to this moment, like I said. But I created this dull ache and pain around that from the distance, from those narratives and stories that I created that, as I said, created that disconnect between me and my family. And as I said before, love, belong, connection is imperative for wellness. And we run away from the things that are ever tried to help us and support us because of as a fear of being a burden. And that's very common amongst people like myself that have been through anything, is we try to protect the people we love. And that's all I did. I didn't run away from them for any other reason than I wanted to protect them. And I'm very fortunate that I've had the love and support of my family from day one to this very moment, because not a lot of people get that.
And was there a diagnosis for you?
Yeah, I was diagnosed with clinical depression and anxiety at the age of 17. And not long after, I experienced a lot of sleep insomnia, which was probably still to date the most difficult thing I've ever experienced. And then after losing a lot of mates and fast-tracking down the path of my journey and being a mental health advocate, I sort of started to understand that what I was living with probably wasn't depression and anxiety, but it was more bipolar disorder. And, you know, I hid away from that diagnosis for a long time until I thought, well, hang on, mate, you're out here delivering to, you know, millions of people across the globe. You probably should own and accept the situation that you're in first and foremost. And so, you know, I got re-diagnosis at the age of 26 and was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, just as I'd imagine that I would be. And, you know, I felt like I was almost more qualified than the bloke that was handing me down the diagnosis, or at least more positive about what I had than he was. So here we are. Nothing changes for me. As I always say, labels belong on jars, not people. And I just go about my business every single day trying to better understand who I am at the core, no matter what the label is, and do my best to navigate myself through those thoughts and feelings that I go through every day, and that's what I want for everyone else.
And sorry,
you go,
mate. Yeah, because my question will be better.
Plus he likes to dominate, but anyway.
Are you on medication?
I'm not medicated, mate. Nah, not medicated, and right. Haven't been for the best part of those 6 years.
Because we've spoken to somebody else who well, some time ago.
He stopped his medication.
Stopped his medication, and yeah, which is why I was asking you, because all I'm getting from you, Matt, is positivity, and I thought you wouldn't be medicated, and yeah, I was right.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's not all positivity. There's and probably come across like that at the moment. I'm doing really well, which is, I mean, the story of life, isn't it? But you know, it hasn't always been that way for me. It's been a continual learning about those things that I'm experiencing. I still frequent suicidal lows and manic highs. I still have days where I, as I said, I experience those suicidal ideation. And it's the difference now for me is understanding the difference between my thoughts and my actions, and they don't have to be the same. So for me, you know, I sit and I'm more present to what I'm experiencing now, and understand that while it's hard for a lot of people to, I guess, grasp, is that I believe that everything's happening for me, not to me. And at least I think that's a better way to look at life, so that when shit does occur, which it does occur in my life pretty frequently, unfortunately, I'm able to then try and find and sit and bathe in it and try and find the gem or the opportunity in it so that I don't make the same mistakes again. So it just, I guess, flipped that mindset for a long time for myself of poor me, life sucks, why has this happened? That entitlement trap that life owed me something. And life doesn't owe any of us anything. We're lucky to be here, especially in this beautiful country. So for me, it was about understanding or flipping that on its head and going, what can I do with the shit that keeps happening, and how can I benefit somebody else with it? And I think, selfishly enough, at the start, I got into the field of mental health because I wanted to be understood, probably not to help other people, if I'm really honest. I was like, maybe if I go and start screaming from the rafters about mental health, people start to understand me a little bit better. And as a result, I've gotten to this place where I just genuinely care about people and everybody in it, because I know if it's possible for me, it's possible for others.
I think you're not the only one. I think I'm sitting next to somebody that we're not quite sure why we got involved in this business, but now we're in it, we know why we're involved, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it's just like, it's those moments that make you feel like you bite down on your mouth guard, and that's what I feel like it's like in this field. It's like, all right, well, I'm really passionate about it. And when I used to hear people talking about it with misconceptions and mistruths and spreading bullshit, I was like, nah, someone's got to do this differently. And yeah, I was a plumber before this. And, you know, a lot of people at the start were like, he's not qualified to say what he is, but I'm obsessive compulsive to this work. And so I was listening to everything I could, researching everything, reading citation papers, studying everything I could so that I could better understand myself and what works for me. But what didn't work for me, I could potentially hand back to other people that might work for them. And so I just feel like that's the game of life for me now. Every single day I still go through, as I said, the same sort of problems and challenges, but it's just about understanding how I can level that thing up and how I can make a life a little bit simpler for myself, which is a nice place to be in, because, as I said, some of this work sometimes from time to time gets tough and challenging, and dealing with people's challenges is often can pull you down, but nothing's impossible in life when we remember our why, and my why is pretty strong.
Now, just before we go to a break, the question that I was cut off, which I think is actually going to be a rip snort. For people listening, and I'm not going to ask the question, what do you tell them or whatever, but how do you help them have a good relationship with their thoughts?
It's not bad.
Yeah, it is a rip snorter. You're spot on, man. Look, I guess everyone's, I'm going to use another cricket analogy. You got to play every ball on its merit, and we're all different. But I feel like everything that I talk about, everything we do in this field and everything in the mental health field, it's not revolutionary, but we've been missing it for a long time. If we can go back and be more present to everything in our life, then we can start to navigate and understand it and then navigate through it. And I feel like this world is doing. And we're not human doings, we're human beings. So if we stop and when we be and be more present to the things in front of us, then we have a greater opportunity of, as I said, accepting it, understanding it, acknowledging it, and trying to dance with it to create some magic. So helping people to just slow down in this world, to be more present to wherever they are.
We hear this a lot, is mindfulness and living in the moment. And that's, I suppose, that's the way you're going to deal with your thoughts, is that actually to be living there and be present. Matt, we'll come back after the break and talk a whole bunch of other things. I know the doctor is champing at the bit to talk about the NDIS. I don't know what your involvement is in that or whether you do have any. But we will no doubt get an NDIS question after this break. You're listening to Coach and the Doctor with Matt Runnels. Also, I'm Coach, not a real coach, with us is Doctor. not a real doctor. I don't know why I'm laughing at that. I've heard that so, I've said that so many times. But you're listening to Coach and the Doctor, thanks to J-Man Active. If the body is active, the mind will follow. Back in a moment.
Ever thought of changing your lifestyle or maybe even your career? But you're a bit nervous about taking the plunge into the unknown. Well, now is the time to get your feet wet. J-Man is an NDIS registered support provider that is now hiring. As the world is adapting to change, it's your time now to not only make a difference, but to also earn the sort of living you deserve. Call 1-800-JAE-MAN or visit our website, jman.com.au.
Dildacare is a team of trusted, caring and professional support coordinators. Founded on the principle that it takes a village, we want to lock arms and build a long-standing relationship, one in which we are able to deliver quality support coordination. We offer additional services such as specialist support coordination and psychosocial recovery coaching. GILDA, Dildacare Support Coordination. We make the NDIS process stress-free. Google Dildacare.
This is Coach and the Doctor, thanks to support coordinators Dildacare, who specialise in, amongst many things, psychosocial recovery coaching. Matt Runnels is with us, mental health and suicide advocate doctor. Question, serious question for Matt or...
No, very serious question. And it is an NDIS question.
Oh, what a surprise.
Are you a participant of the NDIS?
No, currently we're not at Mindful Australia, the organisation that I work with, but we have...
No, really... personally?
Oh, no. I'm not registered with the NDIS.
Because bipolar is certainly on their list, and I'm just wondering why you wouldn't be on the NDIS.
Oh, I'm a huge supporter of everything that's involved in it and the people that work within it, but I feel like my journey's just been about holding on to my own wellness, and I know that that's different for everybody. So I feel like at the time of going on this journey for myself when I was struggling, I didn't even know NDIS existed and what it was. And it's only that being in this field that I really now understand what it is and how you can access it and what's entitled, what you're entitled to.
So nobody's kind of said to you, hey, Matt, you can get supports through the NDIS, and you still talk about your darkness and those bad times. To actually have those supports in place, no one's ever suggested that to you?
Oh, they've definitely suggested to me since I've been in this field, but I feel like where my wellness is at, that I'm pretty across what I'm doing and I stay healthy most of the time. But I wish it had been offered to me or suggested well before I come across the skill set that I now have, for sure. Absolutely. Yeah. As I said, when I was young, the only thing that anybody ever pushed on me was doctors, medication, and a diagnosis. And you thought you were doing the right thing. And yeah, I wish I could rewrite what that looks like for some other people that are sitting at home right now, not understanding what's the appropriate steps for themselves.
Do you feel like people with mental health are not taken as seriously when they're with doctors and medical profession, medical people, as much as, say, neurotypical or able-bodied people?
I feel like the way in which Australia is heading at the moment is now that mental health is more socially acceptable and talked about, that we are also going to come in contact with another roadblock very shortly, which is how much do we listen to someone and how many people are using it as a commodity, as an excuse, now that it's so socially acceptable to talk about. So I do worry about that. But I do believe we've come a long way in terms of being able to give time and attention to those who do say that I'm struggling. But as I said, my concern is what's coming next with it being so socially acceptable that we start to ignore it again.
That people just play that card all the time? Is that what you're worried about?
Yeah, well, we've seen a lot of it in professional sport. We've seen a lot of it in the community over the last couple of years, and that's my fear, that it's become people either use it as a commodity, an excuse, or a get-out clause. And we've seen that, and it sucks that it happens, and it's going to ruin it for those people who really are challenged by their mental health and haven't just made a mistake or a challenge, made a mistake or made an error in their life and need an out. So it's definitely my concern. The more socially acceptable mental health is and talking about these things, how many people take the absolute mick out of it.
And there's no way of knowing, is there?
No, and you have to tread very, very bloody carefully when you're talking about it, because last thing you want to do is tell someone that they're not experiencing something that they actually are.
And I guess for me, one of the things that the coach and I have talked about in the past and on a couple of other podcasts is that for me, and I'm not a doctor, not a real doctor, he makes it very clear every week, but mental health is a physical disability because it's a chemical imbalance. And so for me, that's my champion to sort of say, hey, it's not just a mental health thing like, you know, you're not feeling well. Well, you're not feeling well because you've got a physical disability that you just can't see.
Yeah, well, super important. And everything that we do physically stems from this noggin up here. So, you know, we need to keep both intact. So, yeah, I think, like you said before, it'd be a nice world to live in to be able to help more people to understand what they have access to and what they're entitled to. And that, you know, we can continue to have great conversations that remove the stigmas away from people accessing what they're entitled to so that we can get more people healthy again.
So let's talk about your professional life now. How did you get involved in what you're doing, and are you surprised that you're enjoying it so much? And I don't know if enjoying is the right word, or enjoying the work, or enjoying actually helping people.
Yeah, I definitely don't love what I do, and I'm very transparent in that when I do keynotes across the world. I don't love what I do. What I love is seeing people learn to love themselves again, because that's what I'm here for, and that's what I'm trying to do, is help people to understand what I now know, but that I couldn't see one inch in front of my eyelids at the time. But I guess getting involved in the field for me, when I finally had some acceptance for what I was experiencing, given back, like I said at the start, that selfish, I guess, at some stage of that sense of contribution gave me some sort of purpose. I signed up to do a run around the Bay of Victoria with the Love Me, Love You Foundation when I was 20 years old or something like that. And they said to me, how much of it do you want to do? And I said, all of it. And it was 300 kilometers. And they said, you're mad. But it was giving myself something to aim towards and push towards, which got me on the straight and narrow, because it allowed me to have purpose and a sense of drive towards something. And so when I started hanging around that organization, I was, funnily enough, hanging around like-minded, passionate people about mental health. So I felt like I was understood for the first time in my life. And then from there, that sense of having conversations with people that are like, shit, I didn't know that, or I've helped somebody, or I've said something that's inspired somebody, gave me a sense of contribution. And that's one of the things we're wired for as a human being. So by giving back in this field at the smallest things, as like a fundraiser at the very start, or selecting next on the slides for the presenter at the time at the charity, I was doing whatever I could to feel like I had a sense of purpose. And once I got involved, I was like, I was away and running. And as I said, I'm very obsessive compulsive to anything I do it 100%. So once I got going, I wanted to research as much as humanly possible so I could try to understand it, so I could be better. I was organically pushed in front of a crowd one day to do a speaking gig that I was meant to talk about my run. That's how I was sucked into coming to the event. I was going to talk about my run. And when I got up there, he introduced me as the bloke who'd lost 6 mates to suicide and that he was here to talk about his journey. And I stood there and bawled my eyes out for 30 minutes and people seemed to enjoy everything that I was saying. So I kept coming back and doing it. And now it's got so much that we're, you know, sitting in this organization right now and don't necessarily love every day of what I do, but as I said, we love nothing more than seeing people flourish and thrive again when they believe at one stage they couldn't.
So you're saying 6 mates from suicide. How do you not blame yourself at times for something like that?
Yeah, well, it's 11 now. I mean, I still do. I still 11 mates that I wish I could go and have a beer with tonight, and I don't have that ability. So I guess that's the why at the end of the day. I mean, every auditorium I go to, every place I go to deliver a workshop or program, I see empty seats, and it's that constant reminder of what I miss. And so for me, I still live with that guilt of knowing I could have done more. And there was some, now that I know what I know, I 100% could have done more. But at the time, I was only as good as the information I had in those moments. And that's why for me, I want everybody out there to understand that you are as only as good as you can be in those moments with the information you got. So why don't you go and learn a hell of a lot about the topic and the themes that we talk about, so that when somebody in your world comes crashing down, because they will, that you're ready to rock and roll and give them as much skills and help and support as possible, or to know that what you're doing's the right thing to do and that what you're doing's not making it worse for them. And I think that there is things that people do that they believe is working that is sending people backwards. So for me, it's a no-brainer. We all care about the people sitting next to us. It's easy to say we care. If we really want to show it, let's go learn more about it so we're better equipped when that next mate comes knocking.
How do you not take this home?
I do. I do, unfortunately. Yeah, I try to... Probably the weakness of everything that I do is that I care too much. And unfortunately, there's had to be some boundaries and parameters that I've had to put in place over the last few years. Given that I reach as many people as I do now, where I've had to I've had to say sorry to some people, and I've had to turn off phones, and I've had to change names on social media so that I can't be reached. And yeah, it feels crap. It feels so bad when people want to access you for help and support, but I have to look after myself. And you know, I know that people might muster up all the courage in the world to come and talk to me in that moment, whether it be in my inbox or anything. And if I don't respond to them, what happens? And I worry about that all the time. So 100%, I take this work home, and I don't know how not to.
That's tough. And unfortunately, you can't save everybody. And that's probably the realization that we've all made in the work that we do as well. And, you know, again, we've often talked about having to put your mask on first when you get on that plane rather than trying to help somebody else. And
I think most people are pretty good at understanding that too. And I've just, same as anything and how we advocate, I always say it's all in the communication. And I lead with my heart. So I tell people, you know, I'm sorry, I don't have the capacity to deal with this at the moment, but is there some, I have these people available, or have you tried this, or would you feel confident in sharing what you just shared with me with somebody else in your network? And yeah, I just don't want to leave people feeling alone or isolated in those moments that they really need it. But I do 100% still take work home and struggle to switch off. And I guess anyone who's been through the loss of 11 mates to something that is 100% preventable probably feels the same way.
What about your personal life, mate? What do you like to live with?
To live with?
Yeah.
Again, coming back to the last question, it's about balance for me and trying to get away from this stuff. So, you know, I've got a beautiful partner and a little girl in my life at the moment that bring great balance to me. I love my sport. I love traveling. I feel the responsibilities of this work every single day, but I'm really just at the end of the day, I'm just a bogan who just enjoys a beer and a laugh. And they're the things that get me by every single day, is still being able to feel alive. And that's what continues to drive me too. So anything that scares the shit out of me, anything that makes me feel fear, is normally the things that help me get by as well.
And has the birth of your daughter changed you at all?
Well, I'm actually playing the role of dad. I've come in at 4 years old for this little one. So I'm playing the role of dad and thoroughly enjoying it. And it's definitely brought a lot of balance to my life, a lot of humor. The thought of having kids in 2012 was the thought that saved my life on one of my attempts. And so to now have that happen in my life, it feels like the end goal for me. I still want my own, of course, but still striving towards getting towards that stage of my life. But definitely brought some different elements to me that have made me a better person. I think we can learn a lot from kids. Imagination, that I don't give a, you know, what other people think. The energy, the drive, the bounce. I feel like as we get old, as adults, we lose all of that. And I feel like if we just stopped and acknowledged what kids are good at, and we tapped a little bit more into our inner child, that the world would be a nicer place out there.
Well, there's always a silver lining in anything, and that leads into this question, because obviously you're the little girl and your partner are great things in your life. But out of all of this, what are some of the, I don't know, fun's the word to use, what are some of the entertaining, what are some of the amazing things that have happened to you or inspired you?
Yeah, well, I just feel so fortunate to be in this position. I mean, I'm a huge sport nut. I get to travel the world speaking to some of the biggest, some of my favourite sporting stars.
Drop some names, come on.
Oh, well,
the coach does all the time.
I did Kansas University Jayhawks, which is my favourite college basketball team. Mm. I delivered to them in probably 2016, 15 or something like that, with Kevin Hines, who I was very fortunate to work with. And I got to speak to Andrew Wiggins and Joel Embiid before they were drafted, and you look where they're at now and what they're achieving, and yeah, that's pretty cool. I mean, I've got to meet, you know, the likes of Shane Warne and all of that across my journey doing this work, and I feel very fortunate to be in some of those situations. So as a sport nut, I mean, it'd be nice to work in a professional sporting environment, but I'm very lucky that I get to see different parts of the world doing what I do.
And now, of course, he's met the coach and the doctor.
I was waiting for that.
That's right. Absolutely.
Well, we're going to have to wrap it up, but I want to ask you one more question. Doctor, you got anything?
No, mate, I'm sitting here being inspired, quite frankly.
Inspired. Anything you want to ask us, Matt?
What continues to drive you to eat every day? I mean, you have to have these conversations with people like myself every day, and the passion for NDIS, which is something that people are still trying to wrap their head around. What is it about the NDIS and where does the passion stem from for you two to be able to deliver this podcast rather than to just do a podcast about humour?
Doctor?
That's a very good question, Matt. And the coach and I sat in a basketball stadium in Melbourne about 4 or 5 years ago, supporting some people with mental health problems who were playing basketball, and we couldn't get the smile off our faces. Watching them live their best lives, for me, and I think for us, because we spend enough time together, we get so much joy out of it. And it's tough. Our days are tough, like yours, because when the phone rings, it's normally bad news. There's a problem, there's an issue, something's gone wrong, somebody's having something going on. Nobody ever rings up and says, hey, I'm having a great day today. So those moments of joy that we experience most weeks just make up for that. And that's what's really important.
It's a fantastic industry to be in, even though it can be really, really tough at times. And we get to meet great people like you. So, Matt Runnels, thanks so much for joining us on Coaching the Doctor.
Thanks, mate. Thanks for having us. And, thank you for continuing to start these conversations that are super important to a lot of people out there.
Thanks, mate. Matt.
Gee, what an amazing story for Matt, but also an incredible story of resilience and determination to, not only keep going, but also to enjoy every moment. You're listening to Coaching the Doctor. Thanks to Joman Active. If the body is active, the mind will follow. Next up, we've got Melanie Dimmitt.
J-Man inspires and supports NDIS participants to live their best lives.
We do tap dancing together, which is a lot of fun. She's just so understanding of mental illness, and I feel like I can tell her anything and that she won't judge me.
Now is the time to get J-Man active.
Increased my self-esteem and self-worth, and has just made me feel so much better about myself.
jman.com.au. That's jaeman.com.au.
Dildacare is a team of trusted, caring and professional support coordinators. Founded on the principle that it takes a village, we want to lock arms and build a long-standing relationship, one in which we are able to deliver quality support coordination. We offer additional services such as specialist support coordination and psychosocial recovery coaching. GILDA, Dildacare Support Coordination. We make the NDIS process stress-free. Google Dildacare.
This is Coach and the Doctor. Thanks to support coordinators Dildacare, who specialise in, amongst many things, psychosocial recovery coaching. I'm Coach, not a real coach. Doctor, not a real doctor. Now, don't ask me why I say that every single time.
Why do you say that every single time?
Because there's going to be somebody out there that you give advice to, and it's going to go awfully awry, and I'm pretty sure we'll probably have legal suits coming out as left, right.
Well, we've got a few legal suits coming out at the moment, so just add to the list.
Although, having said that, Dr. Phil's not a real doctor. Do you know that?
Really?
Yeah, he's full of it, Dr. Phil, I can tell you that for a start. But someone who's not full of it, someone who's got an amazing, I suppose you'd say backstory. I've read this person's bio, and quite amazing. Melanie Dimmitt, who's a writer, author, editor, and broadcaster, has kindly joined us on Coach and the Doctor. Welcome along, Melanie.
Thank you so much for having me, gents, and for saying that I'm not as full of it as Dr. Philly. It's a huge compliment.
Well, I've got to tell you, the coach is as full of it as Dr. Phil, so it's great to have you on the podcast today.
Well, Melanie, how do you become a writer? I've always wanted to be able to write a book, but I'm thinking, well, how do you start the sentence? What's the first word? Do you sit there, you know, trying to write, figure out a title, and then scrumple it up and chuck it in a bin and then come up with something? How do you write a book?
Oh, it's really hard. I wouldn't recommend it. And as for writing, look, I'm probably the worst person to ask because I never set out wanting to be a writer. I'm a failed actor that sort of ignored, you know, the fact that my best subjects at school and uni were always the writing ones. I was always keeping journals and diaries no matter what I got up to. I was always really good at writing birthday cards. And it sort of didn't really hit me till my mid-20s when I was doing a job that was, and this job still exists, would you believe, typesetting television guides for newspapers. So literally going through and saying 6 o'clock news, 7 o'clock whatever, and typing these things out. And through that job, I was lucky. I was able to review movies and TV shows that were new to air, and I really enjoyed writing those reviews. And through that, I started doing some entertainment writing, bits and pieces for broadsheet and other publications like that. I started a blog which was called Melodrama. Forgive me for that name. It was about whatever was going on in my life.
I like it. I like it.
I just loved interviewing people as well. I find people absolutely fascinating. I love asking questions. I think everyone has a story. This beautiful magazine called Collective Hub came out, which was all about entrepreneurs and creatives, and I just interviewed a few of my friends who were doing interesting things, like starting companies, and pitched those stories to that magazine. And they said, oh, look, great stories, we'll commission them, we'll pay you. And I said, look, don't pay me, but just promise me that you'll keep letting me write for you. And that was my first sort of ongoing gig, and they gave me a full-time job, got me to Sydney for that, working in a magazine. And that's how I started writing. And then when my son came along, that's when I started writing about disability, and that's how the book came to be.
Well, that's a beautiful segue. Your son lives with disability. How was that when that first happened?
It was rough. So he had a pretty normal, we had a pretty normal pregnancy with my beautiful son, Arlo, but he had an injury at birth which caused brain damage, which at 6 months we discovered meant he had cerebral palsy. And I knew absolutely nothing about cerebral palsy or disability at all, really, and was of the wildly misinformed belief that disability was a bad thing and that our life was going to be awful. I now know a lot better. My son has taught me a lot, and I've learned so much from being in this community and working in the disability sector. But at the time, I thought this was the worst possible thing that could have ever happened to my son and to our family. And I was really, really freaked out and desperate for a glimpse at the future. I would have given anything just to see that Arlo was going to be okay in the future. And that's why I wrote my book special. I was like, the only people that can give me this information are other parents who are doing this thing, who are raising kids with disabilities, who are a bit further along. And I just reached out to parents all over the world raising kids with all kinds of disabilities and said, help me, please tell me this isn't what I think it is. Please tell me we're going to be okay. Give me tips for how to cope with all the emotions and fears I have. And they delivered in spades. And, you know, the biggest message that came through was, you will be okay. Give it a sec. Just let your son show you what this is, and we promise you'll be all right. And that has certainly been the case.
And so, and that was your introduction into disability.
It was. It was a crash landing, as I call it. But since then, you know, my son has taught me so much. He's got quite profound cerebral palsy. So he's a wheelchair user and he's non-speaking. And, you know, before I had him, I would have thought, you know, being able to walk and talk were crucial ingredients to lead a meaningful and happy life. Not the case. Completely incorrect. My son is so happy. He has so many friends. He has such a wonderful life. Yeah, like I said, he's just taught me that there are so many ways to be in this world and to have a good and happy life. And now that I work in the sector, I work for a disability support provider called HireUp. I am, you know, working for their news team, and I'm commissioning writers with disability to write opinion pieces, which we publish. And I've just learned, you know, more and more about this incredible broad perspective and about our world, and that disability is just another way to be normal. It's nothing to be feared. It's something we need way more awareness around.
Yeah, you know, this was something we were discussing, and in fact we discussed this quite a lot, about not having any experience with someone who's lived with a disability, then all of a sudden, bang, it hits you. And you realise then, and I'm not quite sure I want to use the word prejudice, but you do realise that you have some prejudices against people with disability. It's inside you. You don't realise you have it. And so it's that quick learning curve. How do you get that message across to people without shoving it down their throats? But it's a very, very fine line, if you like, to walk along to get people to understand what your life is like.
Look, people will understand if there are people with disability present across every facet of life. If I had grown up around kids like my son, you know, like his classmates are, like his sister is, I would not have freaked out when we discovered that my child had a disability. This is the problem. This is what we're working on. People with disability need to be supported, be present in every single part of life. They need to be able to access every single part of life. And I think once everyone is seeing people with disability in playgrounds, schools, workplaces, on airplanes, on television, in movies everywhere, then we won't have this problem because everyone will know what I now know. Disability is normal. Nothing to be feared. People with disability might just need different supports than what you or I might need. That's all there is to it. It's all about the right support.
And so how long was that process for you from kind of, I guess, the shock of a life-changing information to where you are now?
It was a process over the years, but look, what really needed to happen was, like you said, I just had to get rid of my prejudices. It was all, most of the pain I was going through was self-inflicted. It was all these expectations I had, you know, of having a so-called normal child and a normal life had just been ripped away. And that was where the pain was coming from. Nobody spoke about disability in our birthing classes. Nobody talks about disability while you're pregnant. And again, I just think we need to be talking about this as an option. 1 in 5 Australians, it's possible your child will have a disability. Not a bad thing. They'll just need different supports. So look, it did take me a couple of years. It took me writing a book to come to this realization. And I wasted so much time being sad and scared. That said, every time I was with Arlo, every time I looked into his eyes, everything was fine. He's a happy, beautiful, engaged child. There are challenges, absolutely. He's not always healthy. We're in and out of hospital a lot. But through it all, you know, he's such a little legend. He's flirting with the nurses. He's, even in the sort of hardest times that we have, my son is making things okay. Everything makes sense when he's there with us. If you told me at 6 months old your kid will be in a wheelchair, I would have died. Once we got to the point where he needed a wheelchair, I was begging for it. You know, you just sort of, you stay with them, you stay in the present. By the time you get to whatever it is, wheelchairs, hoists, AAC, IGAS devices, it just makes sense. And you really want them because you know that it's what's best for your kid. But, you know, I'd say you don't need to worry about that. And that, again, that's a lot of what I was killing myself with in those years before I came to this point. I was so worried about the future. Pointless. When it comes, and it will make sense, and you'll be ready. So, yeah, it took me a while. It shouldn't have. And like I said, I think, and I'm hoping for other families with more awareness, which is what we're working toward, it won't be years and years of unnecessary fretting about the future.
Yeah, it's interesting. You make the point about Arlo just needing more supports, and I think sometimes we forget that everybody needs supports. Able-bodied people, able-bodied children still need supports, and those supports are just different. It may be, you know, a maths teacher or maths tutor, or it may be somebody to kind of show them the way. But and I think, whereas with disability, we always say, oh, it's about, you know, supports. But supports are for everybody. And I think that's what we're trying to break down and say, a bit like yourself, this is just normal. It's just a different normal.
100%. I completely agree with that. I need a ton of support myself. It looks different to my son, but it's all the same thing. It's all support.
That's what I was about to ask. What are those supports for you? What do you do to keep yourself level-headed for not just Arlo, but for the rest of your family?
Well, I'm lucky in that we have met incredible allied health therapists and doctors and specialists. It took a while. We've cherry-picked. We've gone through a few, but we have found this A team for my son. We've put them around Arlo. They're incredible supports. And because they will let us know when we need new things or need new exercises, I can sort of come back and focus on what I need as well. So, I mean, I say to other parents who are new to this, get that A team around your kid so you can actually have time to take a breath and focus on what you need. And what I need is to work. I've been so lucky that the magazine I was writing at the time when we had Arlo allowed me to work for them freelance, and I freelanced for many years. After that, my work is flexible. I can write. All I need is my laptop, and that's my whole job. So I've been able to keep writing and keep working throughout all of this, and that's been really important for me. Not everyone's going to need that. I do and did. I also started seeing my own therapist a few months after we got Arlo's diagnosis, and I still see her, and I see her at least once a month, and she's been a huge help. I've also been incredibly lucky, my partner Rowan and I, because he also works in the media. He's a newspaper editor. He works flexibly. We both work from home. We've both managed to stay pretty much on the same page throughout this experience, and I know a lot of the trouble that parents have in this situation is one parent is perhaps at work more and is not, you know, at the appointments, hearing the information with the child. And I really hear often that that is a struggle that people have. They're not on the same page with their partner. There's tension there. So I've been really, really lucky that my partner, Ron, and I have been able to support each other through this. So, yes, I'm quite reliant on him as well.
Well, we've got one more question, Doctor, before we go to a break. Do you have a question?
I was going to ask a question about your podcast, NDIS Know-How. How did that come about?
Oh, again, like my book, Necessity. You guys know how complicated this scheme is. And higher up, the support, disability support organisation I mentioned I work for said to me, you want to make this? Go for it. So they've been very supportive. And it's just me chatting with other parents, also people who are participants on the scheme and professionals in the space about how to make this thing work for our family, sort of decoding it, breaking it down, you know, helping parents with tools so they can go into their planning meetings and really drive home the supports that their family needs to live an ordinary life in the very best sense.
I want to ask you some questions about you on a personal level, but we'll do that after the break because I don't believe there's any such thing as a failed actor. So you and I,
there really is.
You and I are going to have a chat about that in a minute. But we're speaking with Melanie Dimmitt, who's a writer, author, editor, and broadcaster,
and failed actor,
and I reckon just a good all round person by the sound of it. We're having a wonderful time chatting to you, Melanie. We will have a break. And you're listening to Coach and the Doctor. Thanks to J-Man Active. If the body is active, Doctor, do you know what happens then?
The mind will follow.
The mind will follow. Did I come up with that or did you?
Probably me.
Probably you. Yes, he takes the credit for everything. Back after this break.
Dildacare is a team of trusted, caring and professional support coordinators. Founded on the principle that it takes a village, we want to lock arms and build a long-standing relationship, one in which we are able to deliver quality support coordination. We offer additional services such as specialist support coordination and psychosocial recovery coaching. GILDA, Gildacare Support Coordination. We make the NDIS process stress-free. Google Gildacare.
Hi, Coach here from J-Man. Back again with another season of the J-Pod, a podcast that is about living with and experiencing mental illness and physical disability.
Haven't had a relationship for 20 years since I broke up with my wife because I don't feel like I would burden anybody with me because of my condition. It all gets back to that sense of being a lesser.
The J-Pod, brought to you by J-Man Active. If the body is active, the mind will follow. jman.com.au.
This is Coach and the Doctor. Thanks to J-Man Active. Visit jaeman.com.au for all the latest activities. And we have stacks of activities. With us on Coach and the Doctor is Melanie Dimmitt. Melanie, before the break, I said I was going to ask you about being a failed actor. How do you rate a good, a bad, an ugly, or a failed actor?
Let me paint a picture for you. My agency was called Talent on a Budget. So people put me in things when they needed a really average person, you know, in a bank ad, or I did some pretty ordinary stuff. And I tried really hard to get into every acting school. I was declined from all the Whoppers and NIDAs of Australia, I think 3 or 4 years running. I went to London, kept trying, got knocked back from the RADAs and the Oxfords. Like, I'm just not good. I really wanted to do this, but I'm not very good. I did a bunch of amateur theatre. I played a vampire. I played a character from an episode of Red Dwarf that was turned into a stage play.
Oh, really?
Female Rimmer. I'd never watched the show before.
Great show. Great show.
I got some very random gigs. And, yeah, I wasn't willing to sort of live the life of a starving actor. I think you have to really, really want it to make it in that industry. And I just didn't want it enough. And, yeah, like I said, I sort of realized writing's my thing. Writing's the thing, you know, I would do for free. I would spend hours and hours doing it for free. Luckily, I don't have to anymore. But when I started out, I was doing a lot of it for free or in exchange for movie tickets or theatre tickets. And that's when I sort of knew, oh, I think this is my thing.
What was it like biting into somebody's neck and fake blood?
Licked someone. I licked the face of a guy. I was in the stage, an amateur performance of Dracula. and I licked a guy on stage. That was definitely a low point. So can you agree with me now? There's such a thing as a failed actor.
Well, look, the coach is
right up there with you.
I regard myself as a bit of a thespian, but if you look out for a recent budget commercial, you see me, and the only reason you'll probably see me is because I have an excruciating look on my face, because that's when I hurt my back, jumping up and down, dancing, carrying on like somebody who's supposed to be 21, and he's a lot older than that. But acting's loss, as far as I'm concerned, because what you've done now since then is quite amazing.
Can we go back to what we're here to talk about?
Well, we can talk about whatever we like. But
I'd like to talk about the NDIS.
The NDIS, here we go.
I was going on, we were chatting before the break about know-how and the podcast and whatnot, and what comes out of it for you in terms of talking to people and trying to navigate the NDIS? What are the big issues?
Well, just the importance of that, I think you really need to be linked in with a community of families and people who are on the scheme. If you're doing this on your own, no one really holds your hand and says, all right, I think your child would really benefit from these therapies, and you as a family need support as well. Maybe you should think about a support worker. There is no one doing that when you first get on the scheme, or there certainly wasn't when we did. And once you're linked in with other families and, you know, the disability community who are on the NDIS, you really learn sort of what is possible and what your family is entitled to and the supports that are available. So I think there needs to be a lot more knowledge. People need to be talking about that more. Another issue is that every time you go for a plan review, you start from square one. Every single time we go in, we have to say, Arlo has quadriplegic cerebral palsy. This is not changing. And that is extremely frustrating as a parent. I can only imagine how mind-numbingly frustrating it is as a person with a disability to have to go back to square one every time and go through all of your medical history, all of that stuff you probably don't want to be dwelling on. And the scheme is still deficit-based, which sucks. You have to say, this is what my kid can't do. This is what they're bad at. You know, you're required to give evidence in the form of, you know, something called a carer burden statement, which says, you know, how you have to say how hard your life is because of your child and their disability. It's rubbish. It's horrible having to talk in that way. But that is the way at the moment that you get the funds that your family needs. So that's a big issue. But probably the biggest issue that comes out is that there are not enough people with disability actually working for this scheme. So when you're talking to a planner or an LAC, it's very likely that they don't have any experience with disability, which is why you do have to spell out exactly what you need, dot every I, cross every T. So I'm really hoping that the NDIS review is going to see that corrected and see progress. It's amazing we have Kurt Fernley at the helm of this thing now, and, you know, people with lived experience on the board of the NDIA. Here's hoping this will trickle down and there'll be people with disability working across every level of this thing, because I think that will really see huge change.
What about the cost blowout? How do you think that's going to affect the review? Because, I mean, I think there was something came out yesterday that they dropped another $200 million since the start of the year or something. So I guess living and working in the industry, it's the review is exciting, but it's kind of frightening at the same time.
I just think we need to stop talking about this thing, you know, in terms of cost blowouts. Like, you know, things like free education and free healthcare in Australia, those costs have gone up astronomically since they were put in place. The NDIS needs to be thought about as the same thing. It's supporting people to live ordinary lives. People have a human right to lead, you know, an ordinary life. So it really bothers me that we're even talking about cost blowouts and expense and things like that in relation to the scheme. I think we really need to reframe how we're looking at it as just something that's there for every Australian in the same way that healthcare and education is.
Now, I've got something written in front of me. Amy, our producer, who's wonderful, she gives us some great questions. Now, I can tell you now, Amy's not a failed actor. She has done her fair share of acting, and she's very, very good at it. But she's written a question here. You're the creator and host of NDIS Know How, an Australian podcast award-winning series of short and sweet episodes where you chat with fellow parents, people with disability and professionals in the sector who know how to successfully navigate Australia's national disability insurance scheme. So in 10 words or less, what's it all mean? Well, no, I'm joking. Of course, not in 10 words or less.
I was going to try. There you go.
I'll give it a crack. Yeah. What you say, you're our guest today. You let us know what your thoughts are.
Yeah. So the NDIS Know How podcast is me chatting with people with disability, parents raising kids with disability, and professionals all about the NDIS, about how to get the most out of this scheme and to make it work for you or your family.
Beautiful.
Is that good?
That's good.
And my next question is, can we do a co-podcast with you? Would you do a co-podcast with us one day?
Do you guys want to come on NDIS Know How?
Yeah, we could do it together. Yeah. You could be on our show at the same time we're on your show. Would you want to do something like that?
That is like so meta, but yeah, I'm up for it.
Beautiful.
Good stuff. Right. Melanie, can I ask you about HireUp?
Yes.
A HireUp, and there's, who's the other one, Mabel, or these online disability platforms for support workers. Some people in the industry call them the Tinder of the disability sector, where you just put your profile up and you can swipe right and pick a support worker. Do you use HireUp for Arlo?
I certainly do. That's the reason I work with them, is we had an awesome experience. Our beautiful HireUp support worker, Maddie, has been with us for almost 3 years now, and she's a 23-year-old OT student. She walked in our door and completely changed our lives. She's incredible with Arlo. She's unlocked talents in him we had no idea he even had. She's got him down doing 10-pin bowling. He's really good at it. She takes him like bush bashing. She takes him like paddling at the bottom of waterfalls. She's like an adventure OT. So a perfect fit for our family. And she really does feel like family now. So we got very lucky with her. But it was because of her, and also because I interviewed one of the co-founders of HireUp, Jordan O'Reilly, in my book. And this whole company was started because Jordan and his sister Laura had a brother, Shane, who was had a similar diagnosis to Arlo, and they just saw the difference that good, consistent support made in their brother's life. And that just wasn't happening in Australia. They came from the UK where it was happening much better, came back to Australia and like, this is rubbish. You know, our brother sees a different person every day if they turn up at all. So they started HireUp. So as you said, and they don't like when I call it this, but it is a bit like Tinder. You make a profile for yourself or your child. You go on and you search through support workers who are a good fit. So we knew that Maddie would be good because of her background, just got a good vibe. And she came in. And like I said, it was love at first sight for Arlo and Maddie. And they've been unstoppable ever since.
What's Tinder?
You know what Tinder is. Don't be coy.
Oh, no. When you look like me, you don't need Tinder.
Yeah, right. So HireUp have been going from strength to strength there in the industry. And I guess I've seen a number of participants try HireUp, and sometimes they find it difficult to navigate and whatever else. And it's a real interesting model from the traditional provider model. And I wonder, and this is a question of coming from a place of ignorance, is that Arlo's lucky he's got you and he's got his dad and, you know, who are clearly able to navigate it. What's there for people who don't have those supports in place? Does HireUp, how do you navigate HireUp if you've got an intellectual disability, cerebral palsy, whatever it is, to be able to go onto it and actually find the right support worker for you?
They have teams of people to help with that. So I'm at head office, I work remotely, but there's I think 300 people working in-house at HireUp, and they have team building services. They have, yeah, people who work in different regions that can connect you to locals. There are lots of beautiful people there to help anyone. I mean, HireUp might not be for everyone. They don't try and be for everyone, but they are certainly working to support as many people as they can who want to find their own support workers. And the beauty of HireUp as well is they take a heck of a lot of the awkwardness out, and you know, they do all the admin. I know sites like Mabel, it's sort of their support workers are independent contractors, so they set their own rate and things like that, whereas HireUp sets the rate, so we don't have to have awkward discussions about, okay, I'll be paying you this much, so that's all sorted. They pay their employees who are the support workers, casual employees, their tax, super, they sort out all that admin stuff. So we can just focus on finding the right people. So that's why it works for us. Like I said, it might not be right for everyone, but for our family, it's been a pretty dreamy experience.
So you have another child. How's the interaction between them and Arlo?
Pretty typical of siblings. They have good days, they have bad days. So Arlo's nearly 7, his sister Odette is 5, and there's a lot of love there. They have some beautiful moments. Like Arlo is with everyone, he sort of communicates in a million different ways that, you know, don't require any words. So they have their own in jokes, and they love the same movies and books, so they enjoy a lot of life together. That said, they definitely get a bit shirty at one another. Odie gets very jealous that Arlo has all this cool kit to play in, you know, all of his equipment, his standards, his walkers, his eye gaze. She gets quite jealous. And also just at his sort of celebrity status. We live in a small town now, and Arlo, we go out and everyone kind of rushes to him. He's got tons of friends at school. She's just started at the same school as him, and I think she gets a little bit jealous that she maybe doesn't have, you know, the huge posse of friends yet that he does. And we are quite careful that, you know, not to shower all of our attention. Arlo does need more of our support, obviously, but we're quite careful not to get into a sort of, you know, you hear of this forgotten sibling situation. So we do spend quality one-on-one time with Odie. We make sure she has lots of things going on. He'll go to OT, she'll go to her ballet lesson, he'll go to physio, she'll go to swimming. But yeah, look, they definitely love each other, but they also have days when they definitely don't love each other, I think, just like any sibs.
Couple of questions left, Doctor. Chuck one in.
I was going to ask, so what's next with for Melanie and the disability sector?
Well, right now my thing is tube feeding, because my son Arlo, he's been tube feeding for a couple of years, and similar to our entry into the disability space, it was a real crash landing for our family. So for the past couple of years, I've published an annual lifestyle magazine called The Blend for the tube feeding community, where I interview people who tube feed, families who tube feed, professionals in the space, get their stories, get their advice, and put it together in a real stunner of a magazine. I'm working with a designer, Edie Swan, who I used to work with at the magazine in Sydney, and she has created, you know, the Vogue living equivalent for tube feeding families. So I'm really proud of that. That just launched. We've just come out of Feeding Tube Awareness Week. I'll keep bringing that out annually, keep doing my podcast. I've just started producing another podcast through Higher Up called Life Rolls On, which is hosted by this great guy called Steve Ralph, who had a life-altering injury when he was 25 a few years ago and has been a quadriplegic ever since. And he interviews other people who've had life-altering injuries about, you know, the challenges, but also the unexpected, like, triumphs and, you know, what life is actually like after a life-altering injury, just shedding some awareness around that. So lots on the go, lots of content creation, still commissioning people with disability to write stories for us at Higher Up, and loving that. So busy, but all stuff I'm really loving, so I'm lucky.
Well, as a mum, you're expected to be superwoman anyway, with or without a child that lives with disability. So what do you do as a mum when it all gets too much for you? Where do you go? What do? Who do you talk to? I know you say you see your psychologist, but just those moments, do you have a tree you sit underneath? Do you talk to your mum, your own mum, or do you just have a big deep breath and run away for a little while?
A veg. At the end of the day, I try and have it so that no one talks to me, and I'll read or watch something really trashy, like I'll Netflix it. I'm lucky in this community, there are lots of other families with kids with disabilities, so there's plenty of mums I can say, look, let's just go for a wine and a chat. Like I said, my partner and I'm very lucky I've got him there to lean on as well. But yeah, certainly I try and get in a little bit of me time where no one is asking anything of me or trying to talk to me, and I try and do that for at least 20 minutes every day, let's say.
And any big acting gigs on the horizon that we should know about?
I've got a role. I'm going to create a role, especially for Melanie. Melanie, do you have any questions for the doctor and myself?
Oh, gosh. Just no, but thank you so much for having me. Like, it's a real honour to be on your pod. I've really enjoyed, like, past guests. I think we've shared a few guests with Ellie DeMichelier on my pod as well, and I really enjoyed listening to you guys chatting with her. But maybe I do have a question. What is your hope with these episodes? What's your mission? What do you hope people will take away from these episodes?
I think probably similar to you. We just want to try and get the message out that because the coach and I have had so much joy out of working with people that live with a disability, and I guess we just want to try and let people know that because we still, and you know, I've had family members say to me, you know, if you're taking somebody in the car as an example, say, aren't you scared? And it's like, you know, and I'm talking about intelligent people who have still got these prejudices that don't understand it. I guess we want to normalise it. Is that the right word? And we've seen the light later in life, and I guess we're doing everything to let as many people know how great the disability world is.
And I echo those sentiments exactly, but I'll add one thing. I just want to be famous.
You're famous already, aren't
you? Yeah, yeah.
I've been there, done that. Melanie Dimmitt, thank you so much for your time and your wonderful conversation. And we will take you up on that. I want to do a dual podcast with you. I think it'll be absolutely fantastic. And I'm getting nods of approval from everyone here. So thanks again, and we'll stay in contact, and good luck with everything in the future.
Amazing. Thank you so much, guys. It was a treat chatting.
It certainly was, Melanie. Looking forward to our next chat. Well, Doctor, it's that time.
Press hard 3 copies.
Have a great week, coach. Yeah.
You've been listening to Coach and the Doctor. Thanks to Gildacare Support Coordinators.
Gildacare is a team of trusted, caring and professional support coordinators. Founded on the principle that it takes a village, we want to lock arms and build a long-standing relationship, one in which we are able to deliver quality support coordination. We offer additional services such as specialist support coordination and psychosocial recovery coaching. GILDA, Gildacare Support Coordination. We make the NDIS process stress-free. Google Gildacare.